Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a weekly podcast to keep you up to date on what's new on our cloud platform, Microsoft Azure. Your hosts, Cynthia Crane, Evan Basilik, Suji DeMello, Kendall Roden, Kel Teeter, and Russell Young discuss a different service or solution on each show, with subject matter experts to explain how to get started, how different services work, and how to make decisions in tricky scenarios. You can find out more about our podcast at azpodcast.com or follow us on Twitter at Azure Podcast.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 364, being recorded on the 3rd of February, 2021, with special guest Michael Collier. I'm Sujit, and on Teams with me, we have, of course, our special guest Michael, Cynthia, and Russell, who we haven't heard of in a long time. So happy to have Russell back as one of our co-hosts. And we're going to get to Michael in just a minute. As a matter of fact, Michael's not new to the show. He was on the show 5 years ago, believe it or not. So I reached out to him. He's actually in CSC, in the same organization at Microsoft that I'm in. And I reached out to him and said, hey, buddy, we got to get you back on. And, you know, he's got a ton of experience and expertise to share with our listeners. So we're happy to have him back. But before we get to him, let's just do a quick rundown on the events of the week. Russell, thank you for dropping a few notes in the show notes. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, since last time I was on the podcast, I think we'd be here all day. But yeah, I've been learning lots and picking up some bits and pieces. The ones that caught my eye since last week, availability zones now generally available in South Central US and Germany West Central. Confluent Cloud integration with Azure now generally available as well. So this is a service that is it's like a managed Apache Kafka service. So that's a joint collaboration between Confluent and Microsoft to put that in Azure. Backup Center has got some new support for different workloads in it again. So they're on public preview at the moment, but you've got support in there for SQL and Azure VMs, SAP HANA, in Azure VMs and Azure Files, and there's some policies that allow you to do some more deployment of backup at scale in there. The other one was API management. So there's been kind of lots of little updates rolling out and trickling out on this one over the past, you know, every month or so. I think they release and trickle some of them. So there's some updates in there about some more granular control for caching. So if you wanted to, you can say you only want to cache responses that have a status code of 200, or you can define, you know, more granular. So you might want to cover some of the other 200 type HTTP responses in there as well. A couple of other bits as well. One of them was a update to the UI on the portal for the Azure API management as well, which looks very nice. So they've added some service recommendations in there and some service summary stuff. I went to take a look to see how different it was. And it's since I last looked at it, it's been completely rewritten. So I don't know what this update has particularly applied in there, but it looks very nice.
That is good. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, APM management has come a long way, right? It used to be slightly clunky service. It was kind of bolted on into Azure at one point, and now it's just like, you know, part of the Azure family and has that smooth UI feel to it. Notice you also dropped an update on Azure Security Center. And this is just some, you know, they keep innovating that service. They've added new things like the Azure Security Benchmark, which is important. I think a lot of our customers, you know, they ask for these CIS benchmarks for some of our services. And so now you can apply that. You can have Azure Security Center monitor your resources and give you an update on where you are with regard to those those benchmarks. There's some additional vulnerability assessments that have been added for both on-prem as well as the multi-cloud machines. Various security APIs have reached general availability, things like dangling DNS protections, a whole bunch of other updates. We'll put this in the show notes, but suffice to say, they have been very busy off late. And I think that's the rundown for the news. I guess this is the time where we turn the mic over to our special guest, Michael. Michael, thank you so much for joining us again on the show, on the Azure Podcast. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for our listeners. Tell us what you do, what your passion is in Azure, and we'll take it from there.
Awesome. Well, cool. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be back. It's hard to believe it's been 5 years since the first time and the book came out. So it's, time flies when you're having fun, right? So I'm in CSC along with you, Sujit. I've been in CSC for a couple years now, 6 years in January at Microsoft. And I really have a big passion for Azure all up. I started in Azure in 2008, just before it became available, and have really been working on it, you know, since then, kind of as an Azure MVP, and then joined Microsoft 6 years ago to do it for the company. And it's been a lot of fun since then. I kind of cut my teeth on the old cloud services, a big PaaS thing when it was on just like web roles, worker roles, tables, blobs, and queues when that was the Azure platform. A little bit bigger now. Right now in CSC, I focus mostly on our serverless offering, especially Azure Functions. So big into Functions, Logic Apps, App Service, Web Apps, and some messaging like Event Hubs and Service Bus, but mostly around Functions these days.
Yeah, I mean, and that Fundamentals of Azure book that you talked about that you, you co-authored that with Robin 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And, from there, I don't think we had Functions at that point. I mean, I'm not sure how old Functions is. Has it been it's probably it seems.
Yeah, it's coming since then. I mean, 5 years is it seems like a whole different era as far as this year is concerned. It's massively come on since then. I think Functions is probably 3 years old, is it? Thereabouts. Like feels probably, about right.
Yeah, it's 5 years is an eternity in the cloud, right?
I'm not counting 2020 because that's just disappeared.
That doesn't count. Stricken from the record.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us how you made that, just spend a couple of minutes on how you went from that, cloud services world and now into Functions. Like what has been in your mind, the biggest eye opener for you in Functions? Like what drew you to Functions and why do you love it so much?
Yeah, for me, it was kind of that journey of, I'm a developer and I don't really like to manage the infrastructure. Like several years ago before joining Microsoft, I write some code and have to work with the infrastructure team a lot to figure out like what VMs and how to manage all the networking and disk and all that sort of stuff. And it was interesting, but it wasn't what I was super interested in. I really just wanted to solve some business problems. And with cloud services, back in the old days, the promise was you could write this code and you give it to Microsoft in a web role and they would manage it for you. And a lot of times, that really worked as long as you were kind of starting new. Right. And you bought into that cloud services model. And then, that kind of went through some iterations and you kind of fell out of favor a little bit. And with Functions, I kind of get that again. Right. And kind of Functions and web apps, I get this idea of, hey, I just want to write some application and I want to give it to Microsoft and let them run it and kind of manage that infrastructure for me. And they'll scale. And with Functions, what I really like is that ability to scale out. I don't have to deal most of the time with how big of a infrastructure I want, how big of a VM do I want, or how many instances do I want? I let the platform do it for me. And if I do need that capability where I really want to control a little bit more of those knobs, right? I want to control a little bit more of the operating system or, how it scales, I have that capability as well. And I can move it around a little bit. So I get a lot of flexibility with the platform. And that to me is really exciting.
And what are some of the, I guess, impediments that you feel you faced, I know in CSC we work with a lot of enterprise customers, all the big names. And what are some of the impediments that you think you faced with Functions, with them adopting Functions?
Adoption of Functions? Yeah, it's been a journey, I think, with Functions. One of the nice things is seeing like how it's evolved over the years, right, of them adding more and more language support to it. Some customers want, Python, and that wasn't an available language at first. And so seeing Functions kind of evolves, like, okay, now we're going to support Python. And PowerShell recently came, on as well, Node, Java. So getting them, seeing the platform evolve has been really exciting. And as they add more and more features to that, I think there's still work to be done with making parity across the languages. Right? .NET is, and you work with Functions, you can see it is the kind of first class citizen, so to speak. It does have all the features. And then there's some gaps with some of the other languages and just how the model works. And I think they're working to solve those, to kind of fill those gaps in, right? And as they kind of evolve to round out the platform overall. But it's cool to see how fast they're moving on that platform too.
Michael, I'm curious, how should we think about serverless and microservices? Are they interchangeable? Do you always do microservices with serverless?
Yeah, those are like the two buzzwords, right? Like serverless and microservices. And people can get very passionate about this, right? I consider server, or I'll start with microservices. I consider microservices more of an architectural style, and I can host them in many different ways. I could write microservices and host them on a VM, right? It depends on how you write the software. I don't think microservices equals Kubernetes, which it seems to be the mindset in a lot of places right now. I don't think it equals containers. It is Kubernetes, containers, they are, in my mind, a means to an end, right? I have a microservice-based architecture. Kubernetes as an orchestrator gives me some really cool features that are helpful when I have lots of microservices as an orchestrator, but I don't have to have it, right? I can write microservices on web apps or Azure Functions, and that'd be fine. Serverless, I see as, I think I've seen, you know, Jeff Holland, who leads a lot of the function stuff, call it as, you know, less servers, not like, you know, just no servers. There's less to manage. I still have to, depending on what I want, I still have to deal with Azure Functions. I still have to deal a little bit maybe with the operating system. Maybe I have to decide how big of a VM do I want, kind of pin on my workload. Am I, you know, very memory intensive? Then I might have to pick a different size VM to handle that work. But I've tried not to get into the SKUs that much of it, especially the scale out model of it. So I see them like serverless and microservices going very well together. I can have serverless microservices. I can have multiple function, you know, lots of different functions running around. They could be hosted on Kubernetes, and depending on how that's handled, you can kind of configure that server list depending on how you want to kind of view it, right? They can have a microservice-based architecture there.
Yeah, I mean, Michael, one of the things that I've seen with functions, customers always look at it from a security standpoint, right? They're like, these servers are, I mean, who knows where, and how do I know that, you know, somebody else is not on the same server, and, you know, it is, nobody else can connect to it and things like that. So how should, you know, customers think about it, or even our listeners think about it from that perspective?
Yeah, security is an interesting one, right? I think there is a little bit of a shared trust model with security on it, and depending on what security you're looking for, I think there are multiple different avenues and people kind of approach security at. Are they looking at it from, you know, there's a data center perspective? And then I think that's a definite trust on Microsoft or any of the cloud providers like Amazon, Google, whoever, that they are protecting the physical infrastructure, and they've got some software layers in there as well to kind of protect that software layer, the logical layer, right? And then it's your application has to be developed in a secure manner. You know, Microsoft and or Amazon or whoever isn't going to protect you from insecure code that you write. If you leave holes in your application, there's not a lot that the providers can, you know, I think can do to stop some of that. So that's on you. But you can do other things as, you know, developer or engineer working on these serverless platforms to kind of help secure them, right? You can set up your things like identity management, role-based access controls into your services, or network options, right? How do I want to secure this from a, you know, network perspective, which a lot of organizations still get very much into, right? They're looking at virtual networks and subnets and rules there, or IP restrictions. It's a little bit of a, you can argue maybe a little bit of a legacy model that's been, you know, but I think it's still a very prevalent model and still very, very much needed in this kind of new cloud-first serverless world.
That's kind of where I was going, is thinking about functions. You know, it does a lot of the work for you, like any good PaaS service does. It's taking a lot of that heavy lifting away from you. But as a trade-off, you lose control over some of these things. And security, possibly one of them, in that you maybe have less granular control over that network layer and so on. What are the common things that you see, or do you see customers going down, wanting to adopt functions, but then finding actually it doesn't support X or Y, or I need to work around it in some other way? And I guess conversely, there's some things that they'll get benefits from using in functions that they wouldn't have if they were using VMs.
Yeah, I see that a lot of enterprises are looking at how do they lock it down, so to speak, is the kind of, you know, thing. I need to lock this down. It's like, okay, well, what does that really mean? Like, what are you trying to do? Is it nobody, there's no public IP address to that endpoint? Like, okay. Or is it there's no public DNS endpoint that's available? Do you want only certain IP addresses, you know, certain callers to be able to access your service? Then your functions comes with some other things along with it. You know, there's things like Azure Storage that come with functions a lot. There may be other dependent services like Key Vault maybe needed, or Cosmos, or Service Bus is a very popular one. And Service Bus and Event Hubs, excuse me, both of those are very popular options. So it's where, what are you trying to achieve? And then once you know kind of the security posture you want to take, then we can work on figuring out, okay, does the platform support that? Can we do that? What do we need to do to make that happen? And then are there areas where, like, yeah, we can't, it's not really good today, which is, you know, really good feedback. That one things that one parts of my job I like is seeing, getting that feedback from those customers where they have a certain scenario. It's like, okay, that's a good scenario. That's a good point. Let's work with the Azure engineering teams to try to, you know, raise that point and see if like, can engineering fix that? Can we close that gap and make the product better?
How does functions work with triggers if it's connected to your own VNet? What's the setup over there?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. That's a really popular scenario. So there's things like we see a lot of messages or events get into Event Hub, and that Event Hub may be protected with a virtual network, like you say, private endpoints. So that means only traffic from that virtual network can access that Event Hub, in which case then you have this kind of PaaS compute offering, right, with Azure Functions that doesn't, you know, much like Event Hub, doesn't actually reside in a virtual network, but can integrate with a virtual network. And then it's turning on VNet triggers in Azure Functions and saying, all right, Azure Functions, I want you to be able to be integrated to a virtual network. So turn on virtual network integration first, and then enable the VNet trigger support, which says, Functions, I need you to be able to go into that virtual network and look at that Event Hub, for example, and read off messages from that Event Hub, and then process them that way. When you do that, there's a kind of a switch in Functions you got to turn on, which kind of, at least as I understand it, you know, not being on the engineering team, I can view it as there's this piece that is looking at that Event Hub, and it moves that logic over to be so it can kind of reach into the virtual network and says, okay, now I need you to get into the virtual network in there. So there's some software switches that the engineering team has done to make that happen, but it is definitely doable.
Michael, when you talk to your customer, given that there are so many different options within our service offerings, what is the decision process and what are some consideration points?
Are you thinking of like as hosting options or just like, is it Functions or Event Hubs or web apps or?
I guess both, because once you choose Functions, like you also have to think about how you want to host it, right?
Right. Yeah. I kind of start with what do you have now? Like, what is your kind of engineering process like? So if it's a team that wants to, you know, not manage infrastructure at all, you know, they are comfortable with, they've got a very mature kind of CI/CD, continuous integration, continuous delivery sort of pipeline. Maybe they're, a .NET shop, for example, and they just don't want to manage some of that infrastructure. You know, Functions and web apps has a really nice model, right? It could be just you write your application code and ship it over there and let the platform manage it. And if you're okay with that kind of hands-off approach and letting it work, and you can certainly turn on things like application insights and other options to get details out of it so you can still manage it, not completely hands-off, right? But still a little bit of a, I need to know what's going on. And that works great. There are some organizations that they've adopted Kubernetes and they love Kubernetes and all the stuff that comes with it. And you know, maybe they're using AKS or Azure Container Service. It's like, okay, and if they've kind of made the decision they're going to standardize services on Kubernetes, then Functions can do that too. Right? Microsoft has worked an open source model to bring Kata, which is a Kubernetes event-driven autoscaler, I think. And Kata can run on Kubernetes, which lets you take that Azure Functions runtime and then bring the event, the scale out model to Kubernetes, which doesn't do that by default. So as there are messages showing up in a queue, for example, let Kubernetes say, I need to add more, I'll probably get pods, I believe, right, to Kubernetes, let them scale out that way. I'm not a Kubernetes expert, but I believe that's how that works. And so you have that spectrum of options depending on how many knobs you want to control.
Yeah, that's a good one, Kata. I like Kata. But, you know, one thing that confused the heck out of me when it comes to networking is, we've changed how VNets are connected to our services, right? We used to have service endpoints, and then now they have these private endpoints and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Can you just so that we're all on the same page, can you just explain to me the difference between these two options and how it might relate to Functions?
Yeah, that's a good one. I am not a fan of the naming of those two. They are very similar. Right? You have service endpoints, private endpoints, and there's this private link service as well. So it's like getting the distinctions, like what is what and how does it work is, I don't think is exceptionally straightforward. As I understand it and kind of think of it, service endpoints was the first option. I viewed it as kind of a step on the path to private endpoints and private links. Service endpoints allow you to essentially put I like to think of it as a firewall rule in place, is only allow traffic from a particular virtual network and from kind of particular Azure services. It's like, okay, but it still uses the public IP space. So if you have an Azure function or Azure web app and it's sitting at, you know, 200 dot something, it still uses that IP space. It's still there, but it's kind of restricting access to a smaller set of potential clients. And you can do things with some NSG rules and other stuff within that virtual network that you might be integrated with to make rules work. Private endpoints, I think, is more of where, I don't know the roadmap, but I think it's probably where more Microsoft stuff is going on that private endpoints feature. And private endpoints lets you say, I want access only from my virtual network, so only services in my virtual network, and I want to do that over a private IP space. So only on my virtual network's IP address. So if my function or web app is sitting on 10 dot something IP space, that's what I'm going to communicate with. And by default, when you turn on private endpoints on any of the like functions or web apps, the public endpoint becomes disabled. So there is no more access on the public IP address. There's still a DNS entry. There is still the, you know, contoso.azure function, azurewebsites.net sitting there, but there's nothing listening. Essentially, behind it, it's kind of restricted to only allow traffic from the private space.
And in that scenario, if the function needs to reach out to the internet, let's say to call some sort of external service as part of its logic, how does that flow? How does that flow then?
Yeah, so you have options on that. There are some customers that say just let it go, right? And so outbound is generally a trusted service. If you can, it'll let you go out, and that's fine. There are some customers that want to route traffic into their virtual network, and they may do that because they have certain data exfiltration rules or maybe other appliances in their network, and they want to route that traffic internal. Right? You may have to send data out to maybe like a service bus that's also got a private endpoint on it. So it will only allow traffic from within that virtual network. And there's a flag you can set as actually an app setting in functions called website vnet route all. And you turn that, set that value to 1. And that essentially says all traffic now go into the virtual network. So it forces that traffic into the virtual network. And from there, it's up to your virtual network, right? So if you have NSG rules, you can put Azure firewall rules or other things in place that says, you know, allow this traffic, block this traffic. You know, you could maybe make a rule that is, you know, block all internet bound traffic, right? You can do things like that, which that's, if you set that flag, that website vnet route all, that's how you would also work with, you know, a service bus that also have a private endpoint. That makes the traffic look like it's coming from the private IP space of your virtual network, which is what your other destination, your service bus endpoint, would only accept.
Yeah, the other thing that, you know, when it comes to functions, we've got this thing called logic apps, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of has like a serverless feel to it as well.
Very much, yeah.
You know, again, like kind of following up on the question Cynthia was asking earlier, is how do you make that decision that, hey, should I use functions? Should I use logic apps? I know there's a cost difference probably, but from a functionality perspective, what should we be thinking about?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, especially now as there's a kind of a new preview offering of logic apps that's out that runs on the Azure Functions runtime. And I view logic apps as a little bit, so Functions gives you very much of a developer-focused environment, right? I am spinning up some sort of IDE, maybe Visual Studio Code, and I'm writing in Python or Node or .NET. And I have a very, very developer focus. I'm writing code. Logic apps, I think, moves the abstraction level up a little bit, right? So there's a little bit of an editor, right? There's kind of a designer, a workflow piece that lets you kind of stream actions or stitch actions together. And you can get to the code, so to speak, but it's more of a JSON-based thing. Like these actions are here, these connectors are here, and you kind of use them. And that's what they are, kind of what they are. And if you need some more controls, you may not be able to get that. You may have to essentially escape out and call an Azure function that gives you more granular controls. And what I think is interesting now with Functions team and Logic Apps team is doing is taking this managed experience with Logic Apps that, you know, some people would say didn't have a very good DevOps kind of model, right? It was very hard to control. You had to do a lot of stuff in the portal, and the integration between portal and developer was not great in a DevOps sort of world. And by now moving over to host on the Azure Functions runtime, it gives them more hosting options as well, right? You kind of tie into the Functions DevOps model, which is a pretty rich experience. you're still editing this JSON file, which is your logic as workflow, but it then gives you, opens up new options for how you can host that service, because anywhere you could host Azure Functions, I now have the option to work with logic apps as well, and a much more richer developer experience, including there's some preview extensions in VS Code as well that allow you to kind of see, okay, this is what's going on. I feel more like a developer, like an enterprise developer here. I can pull up the, you know, a professional ID if I wanted.
I think I've been looking at logic apps recently. I traditionally would have steered clear of them because I go for the coded model. So Azure Functions and stuff like that is more where I start, or web apps and so on. I think what drew me to using logic apps and has been worked out really well actually was the connectors that you've got access to, and just being able to say, okay, I need some stuff from Dynamics 365 over here. I need some stuff to go out to Outlook over here. To set that piece up and that integration with other services was really, really easy. I did end up having to call out to Functions and then write some mm-hmm. code in there to do some other bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. But tying the stuff together gives you a really powerful back end, if you like, that was doing a lot of heavy lifting and almost a form of ETL going on into MySQL back end that I can then use a web app to go and expose some data on and do some nice fast queries. So that side of it, the connectors and that really rich marketplace for connectors was just brilliant.
Yeah, I agree. That kind of mindset, or that initial position you pose of like, I stay away from logic apps and I want to write more code. Totally get that. And I think one of the interesting parts of logic apps, and people kind of get into it, is that connector piece, right? Because a lot of that stuff you have to write it's kind of plumbing code, right? You're not adding a ton of exceptional value. You're not really solving a business problem by figuring out how to do some of that basic, you know, connectivity work. And if I can let the platform do that and it does what I need it to do, I'm okay. Going back to my earlier comments, like, I'm okay with that. Let me solve the business problem and do what only I can do. And I'm fine with letting, you know, the vendor provide some of that for me. But having that escape hatch that you mentioned, Russell, right, of being like, okay, I need to do a little bit more.
Yeah.
So let me invoke this other thing that I have now a lot more control over, and I can still stitch it all together.
And with the connectors, I know there's a team of people looking after it, maintaining it as it goes through the new versions of the APIs that exist. And I know they're going to do it in a secure way as well. I know they've looked into all that. So I'd much rather rely on them for doing that piece of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point, too.
But I don't think Logic Apps was ever written for developers. Let me tell you, as a developer, I have, you know, pulled my hair out trying to figure out the simplest of Logic App flows. It's not intuitive to me as a developer, that UI. And I think it's probably will be intuitive to someone who's not a developer. I think it's made for non-developers primarily. I have like reached a point sometimes where I'm like, you know, screw this. I'm going to just, you know, write the damn thing in Functions. I don't care to write all the damn APIs to connect to Office 365. It's still easier for me. I know the Logic App folks are going to hate me when I say that, but
I think that's a thing they've heard, right? I think if you're honest with her, the designer has had some challenges, right? You try to do certain, especially once you get to maybe a little more advanced features, right? I want the more advanced properties. I need one more little thing, right? And the designer, I think, has struggled in the past of exposing some more of those knobs and making it easy. And as a developer, you're like, I know I can do this because I've done it in code. And so there is that, like, I think that kind of gut feel of like, oh, this is harder than it should be because I know I can do this other way, right? And I think that one of the things the Logic Apps team is working on is figuring out ways to make that designer some of those more advanced options more easily surfaceable. And they're providing you those options in there. I'm very curious to see how the designer is going to keep evolving with the new Logic App, the preview version that they're working on, and being able to host multiple places, which should give them a chance to go back and, you know, kind of fix up, you know, some of that stuff that maybe isn't quite working like they've seen that they intended it to work.
That's good to know.
Must be hard to get that balance right. I mean, I did end up where I'm putting together rich HTML as the output for some of the emails that get triggered. The UI wasn't coping with that very well. It does its own thing in there. So I ended up going to the code view and working in there instead for a lot of it, or working in VS Code and copying and pasting the bit that I know needs to go between certain quotes. But yeah, it's certainly getting there. I've seen the preview UI and that looks good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Michael, as we kind of wrap up over here, can you tell us what are some of the limitations when using Functions? I mean, it's the greatest thing, but I'm sure, you know, there's some caveats, some things we need to watch out for. What can you call out for our listeners here?
Yeah, I think there's been a couple that I've been keeping an eye on from a kind of a networking perspective with Functions, right? As I mentioned before, Functions does come with an Azure storage account with it, and it uses that to store some metadata that you need with Functions. So there is a lot of organizations will have this need of thou shalt put no storage account on the internet. It's like, okay. So then we need to lock that storage account down to a virtual network. And depending on the tier of Functions you have, you could have two connection strings to a storage account. And depending on, so with premium Functions, there are two. There's an Azure Web Jobs storage account that stores kind of that metadata. And there's a website content file share, I think is the other one. There's another longer one. And that stores some of your application code. And for a while, Functions, you could lock down the Azure Web Jobs storage account and say that one is a private endpoint of storage account, but the content file share you couldn't. And just a couple, I think last week, I think they GA'd that feature to allow that website content file share to be restricted to a virtual network. The limitation with that is it's only Windows premium plan. It doesn't work on the Linux offering yet. So that's something they have to close out the other operating system and make Linux work with that as well. So that's a big one. I think as soon as they can get Windows, or excuse me, as soon as they get Linux working with that feature, that'll be really nice. The other one I've been keeping an eye on is Key Vault. Key Vault, especially for enterprise customers, is a big, I think, need, right? There's a kind of requirement of putting secrets, connection strings, those sort of things into Key Vault. And one of the nice features of kind of the App Service platform, which Functions kind of inherits some features from, is Key Vault references. And Key Vault references today don't work if Key Vault has a private endpoint on it. So you can still, if you need that secret, you could write it your application code. You could write, if you in .NET, it's a few lines of code to go ahead and get a hold of that Key Vault instance and get the secret. And that's your kind of workaround. But it'd be really nice, I think, if Key Vault references worked with virtual network restrictions. And that's something the Functions team has said that they are working on and getting that available. So if they can get storage to be able to lock down and make it work and Key Vault, that will be some really nice options there as well. Be able to lock down more of the platform, kind of the dependencies that come with it that most customers want.
That is great. Thank you. Any more questions for Michael before we let him go? This has really been a ton of great information he's given us.
No, it's been really useful. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, Michael, thank you. If you have any links or blogs or anything that you want to share, I know you're a prolific writer. If some stuff you need to share on other things as well as Functions and networking, please send them over to me. I'll put them along with the recording of the show so that we can share it with our listeners.
Yeah, I will do. Yeah, there's a couple of blogs on michaelscollier.com that kind of go through some of the networking options we just talked about. Some ARM templates, Azure Resource Manager templates there that can help as well. So it's a scenario I think is a lot of fun to work with. But yeah, I can share that with you all.
And on the writing side, any more books coming up or that you're working on?
No, I've had a couple offers to do another version or a couple books. And I think now with two little boys, I am done writing books for a while. They are going to take my time. I think I wrote the first one while I was on paternity leave. And I don't plan on having any more kids, so I'm not going to have several months off to write a book.
Functions for three-year-olds. Yeah.
Not right now.
All right. Well, again, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any thoughts, questions, or just want to connect, find us on Twitter at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixer.org under the Creative Commons license. We hope you'll tune in again soon to keep learning with us.